Russia agreed to one peace plan from the United States. Ukraine agreed to another. President Trump wants a deal to end the war. Can he get both sides to agree to the same one? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. As airports prepare for a packed holiday season, Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy wants a new golden age of travel. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. He says people should be nicer to each other and dress better when they fly. Also, the Grand Ole Opry turns 100 this week. We'll hear from some of the country singers helping to keep its traditions alive. It is Wednesday, November 26th. On this day in 1789, the U.S. had its first day of national Thanksgiving. President Lincoln later declared it should fall on the last Thursday in November. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The FBI is attempting to interview six Democratic lawmakers who made a video reminding those in the military they should not obey illegal orders. President Trump has called them traitors. One of them is Arizona Senator Mark Kelly, a retired Navy captain. He's also being investigated by the Pentagon that he could be called back into service and subjected to a court-martial. He was asked about that last night on ABC's Jimmy Kimmel Live.
He can go after me under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which is the law in the military, which is kind of wild because we recited something in the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and he's going to prosecute me under the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
For reciting the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It
is. Kelly says President Trump is infringing his First Amendment right to free speech. Israel says it has positively identified the remains of a body released from Gaza as that of a hostage taken in the October 7, 2023 Hamas-led attack. It's the latest handover under a U.S.-brokered ceasefire between Hamas and Israel. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports.
The Israeli Prime Minister's office confirmed that forensic tests show the body is that of Dror Or, a 48-year-old who Israel says was killed at his home in the October 7th attack. Or's wife was also killed. Two of his children were taken hostage into Gaza and later released alive. In exchange for the transfer of Or's body, Israel is expected to release the bodies of 15 Palestinians held by Israel. As part of the ceasefire deal implemented nearly 7 weeks ago, all remaining hostages, both alive and dead in Gaza, are supposed to be returned to Israel. There are still two more bodies remaining. Israel has accused Hamas of deliberately stalling. Hamas has insisted it is struggling to find the bodies under the rubble. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
In a post on social media, President Trump said great progress has been made on ending the war in Ukraine. He says he's sending his envoy, Steve Witkoff, to Moscow. NPR's Elner Beardsley has more.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky agreed that the talks in Geneva had produced an acceptable peace framework to work from during a video address to 36 allied nations Tuesday.
And I'm ready to meet with President Trump. And there are sensitive points to discuss. And we think that the presence of European leaders could be helpful.
Sensitive points include the status of partially Russian-occupied areas of eastern Ukraine and security guarantees after the war. Zelensky said Kyiv had shot down 22 Russian missiles and more than 400 drones overnight.
And as long as Russia has not taken real steps to shut down its war machine,
he said no one can take its claims to want peace seriously. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kyiv.
This is NPR News in Washington. Taiwan has announced plans to spend $40 billion to improve its defense, citing threats from China. It plans to build a Taiwan Dome, an air defense system with high-level detection and interception capabilities, and purchase missiles and other weapons from the U.S. President Trump has been pressing Taiwan to spend more in its own defense. Americans are on the move for Thanksgiving, including millions who will fly to visit family and friends. NPR's Joel Rose reports the number of people traveling may set another record.
The Federal Aviation Administration says this could be the busiest Thanksgiving in 15 years. And FAA Administrator Brian Bedford says the aviation system is ready for the challenge.
The airlines, airports, TSA, FAA especially. For us, this week is our Super Bowl.
But there are indications that Thanksgiving air travel could be down this year. perhaps because of travelers who made other plans during the government shutdown. Advance bookings were down about 4% compared to last year, according to data from the aviation analytics company Cirium. Still, the number of Americans traveling for Thanksgiving is expected to set records, according to AAA, with the vast majority, about 73 million, traveling by car. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
The Kilauea volcano on Hawaii's Big Island continues to erupt. It sent lava 400 feet into the air yesterday for the 37th time since the current eruption began last December. The U.S. Geological Survey says the molten rock was confined within Hawaii Volcanoes National Park and no homes were threatened. It's one of the most active volcanoes in the world. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
A boy named Charlie Brown.
In 1947, 25-year-old Charles M. Schultz made his debut in the St. Paul Pioneer Press, marking the genesis of an enduring American comic strip legacy. Schultz's first comic series, originally named Lil Folks, offered a glimpse into the themes that would later define Peanuts. It wasn't until 1950 that Schultz officially titled his masterpiece Peanuts.
Good morning, Charlie Brown.
With Charlie Brown as the central character, Schultz delved into timeless themes such as friendship, love, disappointment, and the pursuit of happiness, all within the setting of a small town. Peanuts soon became a global sensation, gracing thousands of newspapers, inspiring animated TV specials, earning Schultz a Pulitzer Prize for his contributions to the art form. Schultz's first publication marked the start of an incredible journey, cementing his status as one of the greatest comic strip creators in history.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. President Trump is sending representatives to Moscow and Kyiv to work out a way to end the war in Ukraine. One of his aides is the subject of a new report from Bloomberg. Bloomberg published a transcript of a phone call in which the aide advises a Russian official about how Russia can handle the emotions of Donald Trump. NPR has not confirmed this transcript, and in a moment we will hear Michael McFaul, a former U.S. ambassador to Russia. We begin with the negotiations.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez is here to talk about why Trump continues to push even after all these setbacks. Franco, good morning.
Good morning, Michelle.
So the original 28-point plan was widely criticized as a wish list by the Russians. Now the administration says it's updated. Where do things stand now?
Yeah, the Trump administration has been furiously negotiating with both sides, bouncing between a Russia-friendly version and a more Ukraine-friendly one. And Trump now says there are only a few remaining points of disagreement. He said last night he's dispatching his special envoy, Steve Witkoff. Witkoff is the Trump negotiator who is on that transcript. And maybe son-in-law Jared Kushner to Moscow to meet with President Putin. And then he's sending Army Secretary Dan Driscoll to meet with the Ukrainians.
But, Franco, we've been here before. Do we have a sense of whether this is really progress?
Yeah, I mean, talks are happening and ideas are being exchanged. That's something. I mean, it's more than what was happening a few weeks ago. But are they closer to reaching a deal? I mean, not necessarily. I mean, I was talking with Ivo Dalder, who was the ambassador at NATO in the Obama administration. And he says, basically, last week you had Russia agreeing to one plan, and now you have Ukraine agreeing to a different plan.
The problem is Ukraine and Russia don't agree. So you can come up with any plan that the U.S. and Russia can agree on, and any plan that the U.S. and Ukraine can agree on. That's not the same as having a plan that Ukraine and Russia can agree on. And that's their problem.
Last week, President Trump seemed to set this take-it-or-leave-it deadline for Thanksgiving, but he did back off that over the weekend. What does that tell you about his motivations?
Well, I mean, it's another example of how driven Trump is to just get to yes in any way possible. Richard Fontaine served in the George W. Bush White House and now runs the Center for New American Security. And he told me that what matters to Ukraine and Russia doesn't so much matter to Trump.
Trump clearly wants a deal. I don't know that the content of the deal matters all that much to him as long as it stops the fighting. That therefore gives a lot of leeway to those negotiating what the terms of that deal are. And of course, for Ukraine and for the Russians and for the Europeans and for many people, the terms are all important.
Terms are very important, and that's why Russia wants more of the eastern Donbas region for strategic and economic benefits. And it's also why Ukraine wants clear security guarantees from Western partners like the U.S. to ensure that Russia never invades again.
You know, people might remember that Trump talks a lot about the conflicts that he says he has ended. He did that yesterday during the Thanksgiving turkey pardons. How much of this is about his quest for the Nobel Peace Prize?
Look, I mean, I think he genuinely cares about the loss of life. It's something he frequently mentions when talking about the war. But I don't think you can discount his desire for recognition. I mean, he talks about the Nobel Peace Prize a lot. His aides talk about it as well. And Dalder and Fontaine both told me that Trump is likely looking at his legacy. And as any president would, I mean, what better way to be seen as the ultimate deal maker than solving this intractable war?
That is White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Franco, thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
For a closer look at how the U.S. and the Kremlin may be negotiating, we're going to turn to a former U.S. ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul. He served in the Obama administration from 2012 to 2014. He's now a professor of political science and a Hoover senior fellow at Stanford University, and he's with us now. Good morning, Ambassador. Thanks for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me.
So I'd like to start with a Bloomberg report about a phone call between Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, and a Kremlin official last month. The report says Witkoff was giving advice about how Vladimir Putin should talk to Trump in order to curry favor. Now, NPR hasn't confirmed the details of that call, but the president was asked about it last night on Air Force One.
I haven't heard it, but I heard it was standard negotiation. And I would imagine he's saying the same thing to Ukraine. Because each party has to give and take.
Is that a standard negotiation or tactic for a White House official to advise a foreign government about how to talk to the president?
No, it's not standard. I worked at the White House for President Obama for 3 years and then two in Moscow. I talked to the very same Yuri Ushakov that's on this call. I met with him and talked to him many, many times. I never gave him advice for how to talk to President Obama. And I can't recall any time in the Obama administration or studying history when this has happened before.
Why not? I mean, that might seem to be a thing that envoys might do, to say, look, this is what would be persuasive in this situation.
Members of the government are supposed to advise their own president for how to deal with interlocutors, not the other way around. But number two, let's be precise about what he was advising him to do. He was advising President Putin to call the night before President Zelensky arrived in Washington to disrupt the negotiations between President Zelensky and President Trump. And that's exactly what happened. They thought they were going to get new missiles. Tomahawks were being talked about. There was a lot of momentum leading up to the president's arrival with the Ukrainian delegation. And then the day before, Putin called, it appears, because Mr. Witkoff advised him to make that call, and then all bets were off, and we were back to square one in terms of not providing new military assistance.
You recently wrote that, quote, there were signs that Trump was beginning to understand Putin, unquote, but those signs are fading. Could you just say more about that? What do you mean by that?
Well, for many, almost a decade, President Trump's been very loyal to President Putin. He's never criticized him until in the last few months when you could hear frustration in the president's voice. So I was cautiously optimistic that President Trump was beginning to understand he's not going to persuade Putin to stop his war in Ukraine. However, when this plan was floated a few days ago, it just was right back to the old Trump, just giving Putin everything he wants. And that, to me, is not a way to end this war in a permanent way.
But is there leverage that Washington could be using that it is not using?
Yes. I think that, you know, if you look at history and you look at successful negotiations, there's an engagement track and a pressure track, coercive diplomacy, it's often called. President Trump makes the mistake of just doing the engagement, just doing the carrots, and not any sticks when it comes to Putin. I think wars tend to end in one of two ways. Either one side wins and dictates the terms, or there's a stalemate on the battlefield and both sides have to compromise. Right now, to achieve a stalemate on the battlefield, Ukraine needs more weapons. They need better weapons. They need better missiles for their F-16s. They need better air defenses. And we could provide that if we wanted to help them stop Putin's army on the battlefield. That the president could do overnight.
So before we let you go, do you have any sense of what might persuade President Trump of that point of view, since in your view, there's no persuading President Putin?
I hope he'll feel frustrated by this process when Putin rejects the new peace plan. And let me just back up 1 minute. I hope that's not true. I want to be clear. This war needs to end. The best outcome, of course, would be if Vladimir Putin accepts this new plan that Secretary Rubio and Andriy Yermak negotiated in Geneva. But if it fails, I hope that President Trump then pivots to a much more coercive strategy. By the way, it doesn't require any American soldiers on the ground. They just need missiles for their airplanes. They need better air defenses. And that would help to create the permissive conditions for an actual end to this war.
That's former U.S. Ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul. His latest book is Autocrats versus Democrats. Ambassador, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Six Democrats in Congress say the FBI is investigating them. The six made a video reminding members of the military that they can refuse illegal orders. NPR congressional reporter Sam Greenglass reports.
The video features six members of Congress, all with military or intelligence backgrounds. The message, illegal orders can be refused.
We know this is hard and that it's a difficult time to be a public servant.
But whether you're serving in the CIA,
the Army,
or Navy,
the Air Force,
your vigilance is critical.
And know that we have your back.
That was Democratic Representatives Jason Crow of Colorado, Chris DeLuzio and Chrissy Houlihan of Pennsylvania, and Maggie Goodlander of New Hampshire, and Senators Mark Kelly of Arizona and Alyssa Slotkin of Michigan. President Trump called the message treasonous and amplified a social media post suggesting the six members should be hanged. Senator Kelly spoke to All Things Considered.
So we said follow the law. Donald Trump responded with kill them.
The White House later said the president was not suggesting the six be killed, but several reported receiving death threats and bomb scares. The Pentagon launched an investigation into Kelly, and now the six members say the FBI has requested interviews with all of them. Senator Slotkin spoke to reporters in Michigan on Tuesday.
This is a scare tactic by him. He is attempting to use the FBI to scare us out of continuing to talk.
The FBI and the Department of Justice declined to comment. But on Monday, FBI Director Kash Patel told independent journalist Catherine Herridge on her show Straight to the Point that he would treat the video like any other potential case.
Is there a lawful predicate to open up an inquiry and investigation, or is there not? And that decision will be made by the career agents and analysts here at the FBI.
The members say they're alarmed by moves to strike alleged drug boats and deploy the military in U.S. cities. Representative DeLuzio says the ability to refuse illegal orders is a guiding principle for members of the military.
One that drill instructors teach in boot camp. It's one that I learned as a plebe at the Naval Academy that JAG attorneys help commanders train their troops on. Is Donald Trump going to go prosecute all of those people? It's outrageous.
DeLuzio tells NPR he will not agree to an FBI interview and that threats of violence or investigations will not intimidate him from speaking out. Sam Greenglass, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
find a song.
So I found KAXE when I was in college here in Bemidji. I actually can remember being at the stoplights at Dave's Pizza, just jumping radio stations, and it must have been, I want to say it was the Jayhawks, maybe Wilco was on the radio, and it floored me. I was like, wait, how am I hearing this in Bemidji, in northern Minnesota? I thought I had to be in the Twin Cities to get this stuff.
Mark is a member of KAXE. We are people powered. The music that you hear is not chosen by the government or an algorithm or a corporation. It's chosen by your friends and neighbors. Over 70 hours a week is produced by local volunteers. Support the people of northern Minnesota and KAXE with your donation now. Go to KAXE.org.
This station. And from AEG Presents, presenting Brandi Carlile's The Human Tour 2026, with stops across North America. Tickets are available now at BrandiCarlile.com. From Imaginable Futures, funding programs in the U.S. with the goal of ensuring young children and their parents get the education they need to thrive. Learn more at ImaginableFutures.com. From the Kresge Foundation with Pathbreakers, a podcast about transforming communities through innovation. From revolutionizing higher education to supporting artists who are driving change, Pathbreakers is available on podcast platforms. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The San Diego Zoo believes a giant Galapagos tortoise named Grandma was born in 1884. That means she was about 141 years old when she died on Thursday. Grandma lived through two world wars, the rise and fall of the Soviet Union, and Y2K. NPR's Scott Newman looks back.
The first thing to know about Grandma is that no one is actually sure how old she was. If the estimate of 141 is correct, she was born when Chester Arthur was president. The Washington Monument was finally completed, and the U.S. had only 39 states. Queen Victoria still ruled Britain. Stephen Blake is a biology professor at St. Louis University.
I've worked with giant tortoises for a long time.
I asked him, how does an animal get to be that old?
You can boil it down to, you know, drive fast, die young, or grow old with grace kind of thing.
Grandma was born just a few years after Charles Darwin died, but Blake says her parents and the famed naturalist could theoretically have crossed paths during Darwin's visit to the Galapagos aboard the HMS Beagle in 1835.
It's highly probable that there are tortoises alive that were on the Galapagos when Darwin was there. Whether they saw him, who knows?
The San Diego Zoo says Grandma died on Thursday with her family of wildlife care specialists by her side. Scott Newman, NPR News.
When Grandma the Tortoise was very young, a mere 41, the radio barn dance that came to be known as the Grand Ole Opry was first broadcast from Nashville. As the show celebrates its 100th anniversary this week, Julie Height of Nashville Public Radio looks at why it matters to country artists today.
Lainey Wilson made her first visit to the Grand Ole Opry on a family trip to Nashville in 2001. She was just 9 years old. But witnessing a lineup full of country legends, including Little Jimmy Dickens, who first appeared on the show in the late 40s, put her in a serious state of mind. May the bird of paradise
fly up your nose. My mom was like, Lainey, are you having fun? Because I wasn't up just like dancing around, and it was because I was doing homework. I was studying. I was just paying close attention to their every move.
Wilson's studiousness paid off. She's a country superstar with radio hits, sold-out arena shows, and a Wrangler sponsorship. Just last week, she won 3 CMA awards while also hosting and performing on the show. I got the red, he got the favor. Last summer, Wilson became an Opry member herself. Two of her heroes, Trisha Yearwood and Garth Brooks, made the official presentation.
I'm just, I would say I'm so happy for you, but I'm so dang happy for the Grand Ole Opry. I really am. It's just really rare you find somebody at your age that already gets it.
For the occasion, Wilson wore a gold lamé suit with bell bottoms and a flat brim cowboy hat, a glammed up version of her go-to outfit. The power of a signature look is a lesson she learned from iconic predecessors.
If you could tell who somebody is from their silhouette, You know, you think of Johnny Cash, Hank Williams, Dolly Parton. Then you got something that people will be able to latch on to.
Listeners quickly latched on to the Opry when it hit the airwaves in 1925 on a Nashville station owned by an insurance company. Country music wasn't even a recognized genre yet, but a radio barn dance with old-time picking and down-home comedy struck a familiar chord. The Opry's popularity grew, especially when it went national.
Roy Acuff and his Smoky Mountain Boys lead off with their good old breakdown, Ida Red, Let It Go, Roy!
It made stars of many performers, but it had its low points too as the country music industry evolved away from live radio. The Opry found its niche as a venerable showcase of the country music lineage it had helped define. Preservation took many forms. When the show left the Ryman Auditorium for the Grand Ole Opry House in 1974, a 6-foot-wide circle of wood was cut from the old stage and installed in the new one.
Everybody!
Performers now stand on that circle with reverence, says the Opry's associate producer, Gina Keltner, and invoke their forebears.
There's, you know, maybe some Hank Williams or Patsy Cline DNA somewhere.
Keltner and the rest of the show's current leadership aren't swayed by what's hot right now. Their ideal Opry members make lasting marks on country music. These days, they'll belatedly induct veteran artists who've displayed real commitment.
A few that were forgotten along the way, who didn't make it earlier in their careers and might have thought that maybe their time had passed.
Among them is the newest Opry member, Kathy Mattea, who had her commercial breakthrough in the mid-80s. She handled her career with care and developed the vocal style she became known for by speaking her lyrics aloud, then singing them just as attentively.
And that was when people stopped saying, "You sound like Anne Murray. You sound like Karen Carpenter." All of a sudden, all that fell away and I had my own way into a song.
18 wheels and a dozen roses. 10 more miles on his 4-day run.
That's Mattea's beloved 1988 hit, 18 Wheels and a Dozen Roses. She played the Opry back then, but her induction didn't happen until almost 4 decades later.
Now it feels like someone is looking at me going, "We want to own you as one of our family." And to have it come now with the whole body of work that I have, it feels like someone patting you on the back and saying, "You did good."
The Opry functions as a multi-generational family whose elders are worth listening to and whose younger stars, Wilson included, own their responsibilities. Wilson's longtime manager, Mandolin Monchik, says her client makes it a priority to play the Opry, despite the demands of fame pulling her in other directions.
So it's a little bit because it's home and a little bit because it's just a respect thing and making sure she pays tribute to the people that paved the way for her.
Every single one of their names are on permanent display in the Opry's backstage, says Keltner.
They want to be on that wall to not just be significant today, but to know that hopefully 100 years from now, they're still going to be known as a Grand Ole Opry member. That's never going to go away.
For NPR News, I'm Julie Height in Nashville.
I was born in boots on humble ground. These kind of roots, yeah, they sure don't grow out. Yeah.
In the new film Eternity, actress Davine Joy Randolph plays an afterlife coordinator named Anna.
Like a social worker in purgatory, basically. They're the person that helps you figure out where you would like to spend eternity.
The catch, as the title suggests, that decision is final. I'm Juana Summers. That conversation on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can hear All Things Considered later today with your local host, Heidi Holton. You're tuned in to the Wednesday Morning Show. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Thank you to everyone who donated to KXE during Give to the Max. You've made a difference with your contributions. We can't thank you enough. You can still help us finish our year strong. Give at KAXE.org. And the Salvation Army in Hibbing has a free Thanksgiving meal today from 4 to 6. The event also features games, crafts, and karaoke. And volunteers in Pine River will be serving a free Thanksgiving meal at the American Legion today beginning at 4 p.m. Great River Rescue in Bemidji is looking for donations for their upcoming online auction, which begins December 8th. Items like art, themed baskets, or gift cards may be dropped off Saturday, November 29th from 11 to 4. United Way of 1000 Lakes is currently collecting cleaning and personal hygiene items for their Home for Good drive, now through December 12th. There are several drop-off sites in Grand Rapids and Deer River, including Essentia Health and Northern Star Senex. Find more info at uwlakes.org. The 44th Annual City of Lights event is in downtown Nisswa, Friday, November 28th. The celebration includes food vendors, the Polar Express storytelling, Santa's Petting Zoo, bonfires, train rides, carolers, and fireworks. The Northern Lakes chapter of the Minnesota Dark House and Angling Association has their annual fish decoy and sporting show Saturday, November 29th from 9 to 4 at Timberlake Lodge in Grand Rapids. Explore spearing and ice fishing equipment, a silent auction, and more. And you can cut your own Christmas tree in the Superior or Chippewa National Forests. Permits are now available at recreation.gov. You may also stop by a district office to get a permit. Now it's time for your daily dose of phonology.
On today's date, November 26th in 1986, I get a report of common loons congregating on Sugar Lake south of Grand Rapids. There are more than 25 loons in the flock, and 20 of them will dive at a time, feeding, grabbing up shiners and eating them, while the others sit quietly on the surface and keep an eye out for any predators that might come by. These are more than likely juvenile loons that have no parents around and are simply waiting for the opportunity to head south. And when that notion strikes them, they will, in fact, get up and start south. It's not as simple as it would be for the parents. The parents oftentimes head south just over to Lake Michigan, down to Tennessee, and out into the ocean, and it's a pretty quick process. But these guys are novices, and sometimes their wanderings will take them all across the eastern half of the United States as they search out a way to find the ocean.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features presenting Hamnet, directed by Chloe Zhao, starring Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal, now playing in select theaters everywhere December 5th. From Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor can help build a flexible wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Americans are going to be on the move for the Thanksgiving holiday, and that includes millions who will fly to visit family and friends.
Federal regulators say the U.S. aviation system is back to normal after the government shutdown. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy is urging travelers to be on their best behavior as they head to the airport.
It's my responsibility to behave well. I can't offload that to anybody else. It's me. And how am I going to behave? How am I going to have my kids behave as we travel together? How I dress? I'm not trying to put a blame on anybody. I'm just asking us all to be better and do better.
These remarks prompted a lot of reactions, so we've called NPR transportation correspondent Joel Rose. Joel, good morning.
Hi, Steve.
Are you dressed well for this interview?
This is radio, Steve. I don't have to answer.
Okay, fine, fine. We'll just assume. We'll imagine. What is the transportation secretary asking here?
Yeah, this is what the Department of Transportation is calling a civility campaign, which it has dubbed, quote, the golden age of travel starts with you. Secretary Duffy is encouraging travelers to treat airport and airline staff with respect, to dress better, as you noted, and to show more courtesy to other passengers as well. The timing on this is a little bit puzzling. There was a big uptick in episodes of unruly passengers during the COVID pandemic, but those numbers have come down a lot since then. And the administration's critics note that this campaign is putting a lot of pressure on passengers while seemingly letting airlines off the hook for their part in making flying less civil. And some critics have noted the Trump administration is simultaneously rolling back rules about how airlines have to treat passengers.
Well, if I'm heading to the airport, what should I expect today?
I would look for big crowds. The Federal Aviation Administration says this could be the busiest Thanksgiving in 15 years, with a peak of more than 52,000 scheduled flights yesterday alone. AAA says about 6 million people are expected to fly in the week before and after the holiday, though AAA also cautions that number could wind up slightly lower if some air travelers made other plans because of the flight disruptions that happened during the government shutdown. Mm. There are indications that advanced bookings this year are down a bit compared to last year, off by about 4%, according to data from the aviation analytics company Cirium, which suggests that maybe demand is not quite where the airlines expected it would be coming out of the shutdown. But, you know, in any case, you should expect the airports to be very busy.
Is the system ready?
The FAA says yes. I mean, the agency says air traffic controller staffing is back to normal levels. Those controllers, of course, were required to work without pay during the shutdown. Some took on second jobs and many called out sick. That led to staffing shortages at many facilities. And it eventually pushed the FAA to order flight reductions at dozens of major airports, though those limits are now lifted.
How can we measure the morale of air traffic controllers after they went so many weeks without being paid?
It's an interesting question. The Department of Transportation has said it will give $10,000 bonuses to air traffic controllers who did not miss a single shift during the 43-day shutdown, a proposal originally suggested by President Trump. But only a small fraction of working air traffic controllers will qualify. Just 311 controllers out of more than 10,000 will get the cash bonuses, according to the controllers union. And that's causing some resentment among those who did not qualify. Some have called the bonuses unfair and even a betrayal of those who did a lot of hard work during the shutdown.
NPR's Joel Rose, who will be among the millions flying today. Joel, where are you headed?
New Orleans, Louisiana.
Oh, wow. Sounds great. Enjoy. Take it easy.
You too.
After Democrats won elections this month in New Jersey, Virginia, and Pennsylvania, the party is now eyeing a race in Tennessee. The special congressional election is for a district that has been solidly Republican for decades, but is now more competitive. Early voting is already underway. So Mariana Bacayel from member station WPLN in Nashville headed to the polls to check in with voters.
Overlooking U.S. Route 70 and the neighboring Dollar General, the City Hall of Pegram, Tennessee has opened its doors as an early voting site. It's one of many in the state's 7th congressional district, which is holding a special election that concludes on December 2nd. Here in Cheatham County, President Trump won with 72% of the vote last year. Trump endorsed the Republican congressional candidate Matt Van Epps. Some voters say they cast a ballot for the former state commissioner because
there's a lot of work to do because a lot of work didn't get done 4 years ago.
Making sure that President Trump has the support he needs to carry out his agenda.
Well, it's like the moral values. I like to get away from the issues of transgenderism and homosexuality. And I like somebody that's backing the way Trump's got the country going.
That was Pam, Michael, and Jeff. All three refused to give their last names because they wanted to keep their ballot choices private. But not everyone in Cheatham County is happy.
I don't know how you could say the price of groceries or anything are coming down
unless you've not been to the grocery store. Everything's more expensive.
That's Becky, who also wanted to keep her last name private. She says she voted for Democratic congressional candidate Afton Bain because she's worried about her daughter, who's just graduated college.
And she has no chance of being able to live on her own. Everything is expensive.
She's not alone. Affordability is top of mind for Nashville voters, along with
safety, money, jobs,
housing.
Inflation is outrageous, you know.
That was Abraham Garcia Ortega and Jasmine Patterson. They also cast their vote for Bain, a state lawmaker. She and Van Epps are vying for a seat left open by the retirement of Congressman Mark Green. While Green has held the seat since 2019, his surprise retirement could present an opportunity for Democrats. This month, the Cook Political Report, a nonpartisan newsletter, changed the 7th Congressional District's rating from solidly Republican to likely Republican. The state's GOP chair, Scott Golden, says he's focused on turnout at a time when many voters may be traveling or hosting for the holidays.
Anytime you have a special election bracketed by the Thanksgiving holiday, you can't afford to take a day off. You know, I think if there's concern, it's just that, you know, people aren't aware that they have the opportunity to vote right now.
The recent Democratic wins across the country may also help build momentum for their candidate, even in a district that's been a Republican stronghold for decades. Tennessee Democratic Party Chair Rachel Campbell says Bain's focus on affordability, like the cost of groceries, could give her an edge.
My belief is that we're winning because we're focused on the real issues that families are facing, not just in Tennessee, but all across the country.
A recent NPR PBS News Marist poll found that nationwide, nearly 6 in 10 respondents say Trump's top priority should be lowering prices, and no other issue comes close. Trump is unpopular nationwide with an approval rating of 39%. In Tennessee, though, his base is still strong. For NPR News, I'm Mariana Baca-Yao in Nashville.
This afternoon on All Things Considered, Elsa Chang visits the Sistine Chapel of New Deal Art. It was the home of the Social Security Administration, but decorated with murals about the importance of the program. Now the Trump administration is trying to sell the building, and art historians are worried it could get demolished. Listen in on the NPR app, on a smart speaker, or this public radio station. This is NPR News.
KEXE brings you a brand new podcast, Season Watch, exploring the seasonal wonders of life in northern Minnesota. Voices like Charlie Mitchell, John Latimer, and our listeners. Find it on most podcast platforms. Season Watch is a podcast for those who are curious about the changes in nature.
You are tuned in to Morning Edition here on the Wednesday Morning Show. My name is Andrew DeZingle here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. KAXE News is working on a story explaining the complex workings behind your property taxes, but we need your help. Share your property tax statement and your questions with us by emailing news at kaxe.org. These real-world examples will help everyone better understand how and why you may be seeing your taxes rise. The Bemidji Senior Center invites you to a Christmas concert with the First City Singers Monday, December 1st at 4 p.m. The Friends of the Brainerd Public Library continue their Brown Bag Author Series Monday, December 1st at noon with Minnesota author Will Weaver. He will talk about his new book, Black Dirt, Bright Stars, a sequel to Power and Light. The Aitken Fish House Parade is Friday, November 28th at 1 p.m. There are a variety of events before and after the parade. Find a full schedule at aitken.com/fishhouseparade. The Grand Rapids Centennial Rotary Club offers a free Thanksgiving meal on Thursday, November 27th from 11 to 1 at St. Joseph Catholic Church. And the Old Scenic Community Church in Big Fork is hosting a free meal on Thanksgiving from 1 to 4 p.m. And Floodwood New Life Community Church hosts a free public meal on Thanksgiving Day at 12 p.m. Open to all. Now for more from Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from MS Now, home to The Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more. MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. Learn more at ms.now. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. This program is supported by a network of local stations across the country. NPR also supports regional newsrooms like the Gulf States Newsroom, which we will hear next. They are reporting on Meta, which is building the world's largest artificial intelligence data center. Meta released a graphic showing that if this building was in New York, it would cover much of Manhattan. The building is not in Manhattan, but in Louisiana, where construction has caused traffic and a dangerous road, according to an investigation by Drew Hawkins of the Gulf States Newsroom.
Since construction started in December, thousands of dump trucks and 18-wheelers roll through the town of Holly Ridge every day. Fourth grader Penelope Hull says the truck noise on the busy roads outside Holly Ridge Elementary shakes the classroom.
You can't pay attention and you get too, like, what is that? And you lose what the teacher was telling you to do.
As of September, crashes are up more than 600% on the roads surrounding Meta's new data center. At least 64 crashes this year, compared to just 9 last year, according to police records. School officials shut down the playground next to the road this year because it's not safe.
That's why they're saying we shouldn't go out there and all that, because there's too many wrecks and Meta trucks and they could crash. I really love that playground.
In one crash, two dump trucks collided near the school. The driver who caused it had an expired Mexican license, and he had to be airlifted from a field behind the school to a hospital on a school day. Over a dozen people who live near the construction site describe truck drivers heading to and from the Meta site as dangerous and reckless. Robin Williams says she's afraid to leave her own driveway.
I've almost gotten a wreck leaving out of my road, down by the schoolhouse. They think they run the roads.
Her husband Joe agrees.
When you get in that car and get ready to leave, you better pray that you can make it to your destination.
Police reports back up what residents say. In some crashes, truck drivers couldn't see or hear smaller vehicles before colliding into them. At least two drivers fell asleep at the wheel, and one left his wrecked vehicle at the scene so he wouldn't miss a morning meeting at Meta. In another crash, the driver didn't even have a license. Brian Walshin studies highway safety at Louisiana State University. He says these crashes are the fault of the drivers and Meta.
Just because you come rolling in your Meta and you're this trillion-dollar company and you roll into, you know, West Yahoo, Louisiana, I think it's incumbent of them to be a good steward of the public trust.
Louisiana's Department of Transportation and Development said in a statement Meta hasn't violated its permits. But those permits require minimizing impacts and keeping people safe. Meta says it sets strict guidelines about speed and safety, but did not address specific crashes. The governor's office and Richland Parish Sheriff did not respond to questions for this story, but they've heard complaints from residents. In June, Governor Jeff Landry even visited Holly Ridge. Speaking to local TV station KNOE, he acknowledged the traffic concerns and promised control measures.
Because guess what? That project is transformational for this area, but like with all good things, it comes with good problems.
Meta says construction will last at least another 5 years. Residents say they want safer roads, and they want the trucks working on the Meta site to obey traffic laws and face consequences for breaking them. For NPR News, I'm Drew Hawkins in Holly Ridge, Louisiana.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Sometimes we need a bright spot in our day. That's what you get when you tune in to KAXE.
And our ancestors show us, in the face of incredible adversity, what it looks like to persevere, what it looks like to keep moving your feet forward. You know, Martin Luther King talked about, if you can't walk, then you should crawl, right? But you must keep going. So my encouragement is, you do have an important role to play, and you must not grow weary in doing good. Rest if you must, but do not quit.
Minnesota author Sharon McMahon from a KAXE Conversation. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting the bright spots that you hear. You can text the word donate right now to 218-326-1234.
The Medicare system and patients on Medicare will get a discount on some popular drugs that treat diabetes and obesity.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on Think or Swim. More at Schwab.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. We're leading with a follow-up move by the Trump administration aimed at lowering the prices of weight loss drugs, including Ozempic and Wegovy. Marketplace's Henry Epp is here live with more. Henry?
Yeah, Medicare will get a 71% discount off the list price of Ozempic and Wegovy starting in 2027. And that'll bring the monthly costs of those drugs down from nearly $1,000 to $274. Novo Nordisk, the maker of these drugs, recently also lowered the monthly price for existing patients who pay out of pocket. And the Trump administration also announced earlier this month that some future obesity drugs from Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly will be available for lower prices through a government-run website. And the administration has said that site will launch early next year. And these aren't the only drugs that'll be discounted. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services announced price reductions for 14 other drugs, also starting in 2027.
And how did this Medicare Services outfit pull off these discounts, Henry?
Yeah, so they can negotiate some drug prices because of this bill that was signed by former President Joe Biden back in 2022. That was the Inflation Reduction Act. That bill allowed CMS to negotiate the price of 15 drugs per year with pharmaceutical companies for the first time. But the law didn't allow those negotiated prices to take effect until 2026. So we're about to see the first batch of them in January. And these are lower prices for certain diabetes drugs and also a popular blood thinner. The Biden administration negotiated those last year. And then we'll see the next round of negotiated prices in 2027 for Ozempic and Wegovy and some others.
Henry, thank you for this. Let us check the markets. I see S&P futures are up 0.3%. NASDAQ futures are up 0.5%. Now, Dow futures up 0.2%. The 10-year interest rate is down this morning, 4%, just about to start the day before the day off. From ordering up government stakes in publicly held companies such as microchip maker Intel to telling Cracker Barrel to go back to its original logo, President Trump often works to mix government into the private sector. Now there are reports that the studio Paramount Skydance may revive a dormant movie franchise, Rush Hour, at the urging of the president. Trump is a booster of the franchise's director, Brent Ratner, whose career slowed after allegations of sexual misconduct, which he denies. Ratner is now working with Amazon on a documentary about First Lady Melania Trump. Meanwhile, Paramount is among bidders for another studio, Warner Brothers, that could face federal antitrust scrutiny, whichever company wins that bid.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals who want to join an inclusive and unique culture. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And by Total Wine and More, offering wines, beers, and spirits for fall celebrations. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Drink responsibly. B21.
Feeding America is the largest nonprofit tackling hunger in the country. It distributes billions of pounds of food each year from 200 food banks. Feeding America used to employ an algorithm to sort out those complicated logistics. It generated a list of food banks based on need. And when a shipment of food became available, Feeding America then called the food bank at the top of the list. But if a food bank didn't need or want that donation for any reason, it presented a problem, a solution, good old market economics. Harshan Ratanpal reports from Missouri.
Just about every morning when Daryl Bascom gets to the office, he logs onto his computer and immediately starts bidding online.
It's kind of fun to go out and shop each day.
We're not talking about eBay here. Bascom works at a food bank in Columbia, Missouri, and he's bidding on truckloads of food.
We have a bid coming up at noon. I found a snack load on there. It had some Slim Jims. It has some Angie's popcorn.
But what Bascom really wants today is a truck of baby formula. The government shutdown affected some programs that usually provide formula to families who need it.
All the food banks have been scrambling, trying to figure out how can we get baby formula into the network.
But to get the formula, he'll have to outbid hundreds of food banks on this choice system, Feeding America's method of deciding who gets what. If a food bank really wants a certain truckload, they can place a high bid. Whoever bids the most wins that truckload. Every day, currency, sort of like digital fake cash, is redistributed among the food banks. It's the brainchild of Canis Prendergast, an economist at the University of Chicago. When he started working on this, he remembers talking to a man named Roger about the old system.
And Roger says, "I'm sick of them giving me potatoes."
Roger was a food bank director in Idaho.
"I have so many potatoes here already. I have a warehouse full of potatoes."
The problem was Feeding America had no way to know that one food bank might be overflowing with potatoes and another might desperately want some. So Prendergast proposed this market economy where food banks use fake cash to indicate they don't want potatoes but would love baby formula. He tried to make the system efficient and equitable.
There's an inherent fairness in it.
For example, food banks in areas with higher poverty get more points to spend. And it's working. Prendergast says food banks value the donations through the choice system much more than before.
In a world where people want very different things, but you're not sure exactly what they want, sometimes markets, if they're designed well, can facilitate choice in that way.
But markets can't solve scarcity. Back in Missouri, it's now noon, and Daryl Bascom, with the food bank, is seeing how he fared with the bid system. He did win that truck of snacks for 3,000 points, but
what did that load of baby formula go for in the end?
It went for 40,000 points.
He lost to a food bank in New York that spent more shares on formula that day than Bascom had in his whole account. In any economy, you can't always get what you want. In Missouri, I'm Harshan Ratanpal for Marketplace.
But you can get this if you want. Our free Daily Wrap newsletter brings you the day's news on money, markets, innovation, workplace culture, straight to your inbox weekday evenings. Our crew puts out a tight, sparkling read, I would say. Sign up for the Marketplace Daily Wrap free, marketplace.org/subscribe. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio with our morning report. We are from APM, American Public Media.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. The American Legion Post 49 in Pequot Lakes is hosting a free will dinner on Thanksgiving from 11 to 3 p.m. And there is a free Thanksgiving meal at MJ's Lodge and Resort in Pengilly from 1 to 4 p.m., featuring a free will donation for the Noshwalk Food Shelf. On the River is our volunteer-hosted mix of folk, rock, jazz, blues, and world music on KAXE 7 days a week. Trained community members choose the music every weekday at 1 and 7, plus Saturdays at 4 and Sundays at 1. Big thanks to our dedicated